So, it's my pleasure to welcome myself and Stuart Goodnick back to Many Rivers Books and Tea. We are two of the founders of the store, along with our friend Jim over here. We don't talk that often these days, but a few weeks ago, I was in fact reading the work of Ursula Le Guin, a book, a very thick book of her novellas that I had never read before. And I was reminded of her pursuit and exploration of the theme of freedom, because she has a lot of meditations on what political freedom means, what freedom for gendered bodies means, what freedom in a spiritual sense means. And I realized, oh, this is something that would be fun for us to explore and talk about. Stuart and I have a radio show called The Mystical Positivist, and it's a theme, spiritual freedom is a theme that has come up incidentally, it seems to me, along the way in our show. We now have over 302 shows in the can, as it were, on the podcast site. But I don't think we've ever explicitly addressed it. And so I was thinking about the ways in which freedom is sort of lionized as an ideal that everyone should want to pursue, but also what does it mean to have or to exercise spiritual freedom? I don't think that's something that we think about that commonly, in terms of people who have a real interest in self-exploration, self-examination, and what kind of freedom that might lead to. So I should probably stop talking and let Stuart say something here, because I'm just going
on.
I'll just go on and on. I'll just go on and on.
You're free to, though. So there's a lot of ways to approach this topic, and I certainly encourage everyone to throw questions out or add to the conversation. But when we look at freedom and what spiritual freedom might mean, there's a couple of associations that come up. One of them is in the Vedic traditions, we have the notion of moksha, which is typically translated as freedom.
Or release.
Yeah, or release.
Release from the...
But there's an implication of freedom. And at the same time, in some traditions, there's the, for instance, in a tradition that of what I would call Western Baal, which was pioneered by a teacher, Lee Lozowick, who led a community in Prescott and internationally. He would often speak about spiritual slavery or slavery to God. And in some ways, he was equating the two things. And so it's an interesting contrast, because on the one hand, there's the idea of release and freedom, and the other hand, there's the idea of slavery to the divine. And it's an interesting exploration that we'll get into this evening as to whether those are the same or different. Are those opposed? Are they different, or are they? Are we speaking about the same thing? The other question that comes up for me is, when I use a word like freedom, there is the invitation to ask, freedom from what? So typically, when we construct the notion of freedom in our, at least our Western minds, there's the idea that somehow we're constrained, or somehow we're blocked, or somehow we're held captive, and freedom tells us that we are somehow released from this thing that's been holding us back. So, you know, very bluntly, I'm getting to an age where I start to look about retirement from my professional life. So there's this very natural sense of, oh, freedom from something. And it's an interesting question, because the question is, well, do I feel not free now? Will I feel free then? Will anything really be different? What's going on there? So that's a starter for this. Probably will throw that back to you too.
Well, first I'll ask if there's any comments, questions along the way.
But it occurred to me that the freedom from something allows the freedom to something at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you just want to get out of a situation without.
Yeah, arises in relation to that is the, you know, I usually think in terms of freedom from something and the able to think of bondage to something. So bondage to, freedom from, there always seems to be this idea of escape. And sometimes spiritual dialogue and spiritual communication is couched in terms of an escape from something. You know, there's an escape from the ordinary, the escape from...
There's the escape from our habit energies that by which and through which we recreate our pasts and remain sort of locked in not just actions that we commit in response to what people do or say to us, or situations we find ourselves in that may resemble to a greater or lesser extent things that have happened before, but also, you know, the whole ways in which our habit energies condition how we see what's actually happening. In other words, are we misperceiving what's actually going on when someone said X to me? You know, I had the reaction of, oh, they were disrespecting me, they were treating me like crap, they were etc., etc. And really, if I ask them about it, I can actually perhaps discover whether that was true. Maybe it wasn't true. In fact, surprisingly, or not surprisingly, I should say, often that can be the case. But on the other side, it's the same thing. Maybe in fact, romantic literature is full of people having misunderstandings about, you know, I thought you really had an attraction to me, but actually you were just being nice in a situation that had nothing to do with my projection onto you about what you were saying, doing, or enacting. So there's one arena of freedom then can be freedom from our own projections about what other people are doing, and consequently then freedom from our own compulsive habits about what we're doing in response to that.
So that, for me, leads to another level of consideration, which is whether freedom is something that is defined so much structurally as in terms of exterior conditions, or is freedom more of a feeling state or a condition of our being? So can I feel freedom regardless of what my external circumstances are? And if that's the case, or you may or may not accept that premise, but if you go with that premise for a moment, then the interesting question is, well, what would have to be the case for me to experience a sense or a feeling of freedom regardless of the physical circumstances? Like, for instance, suppose I was diagnosed with cancer and had to contend with that. Is it possible for me to feel freedom? Is it possible for me to feel freedom if I were arrested and thrown in prison? Is it possible to feel freedom if I lose my job under negative things? Is it possible to feel freedom when something positive that's been happening to me ceases happening and I just go on with my life? I think when I frame it that way, we can imagine circumstances where it might be possible to feel freedom without reference to the structure of external circumstances, which then suggests that the inquiry about what freedom really means might be better explored by looking at the internal structure, which gets back to kind of what Rob was saying, that if it is the case that I can have ideas about circumstances outside of myself, and I can discover through interactions with the world that my ideas about things outside of myself actually are not correct, or that they are mistaken grossly or subtly, then it may be possible that by looking at the structure of my ideas about the world around me, I might discover a way into accessing a feeling state or an experience of freedom, regardless of what's happening outside of myself.
So, just to back up slightly from what the point Stuart was just making, you know, one metaphor that gets used a lot to talk about a freedom from reactivity or projection is the idea of going with the flow, right? The idea that life is like a river, and there are currents and subcurrents and eddies and etc. And so freedom has to recognize and encompass that reality. And I think, you know, that's a useful and helpful metaphor. But I also want to point out that that metaphor doesn't encompass some of the extremes that might be possible. So, you know, if I put myself in, or if I find myself in a situation where I am not going to continue down the river. So I just heard about this Japanese billionaire who's going to go on the trip around the moon in a few years, right? Supposedly, wouldn't that be great? Well, here's a man who has the money, and thus the power, to enact a fantasy that very few human beings could imagine doing in the near future, and yet if he's on that spaceship, he steps outside the spaceship in his spacesuit, if he opens his mask or a micrometeoroid punctures his suit, he'll die in a second, potentially. So that's as much part of the river. I want to make the point that that's as much part of the river, that kind of situation. I mean, there was a guy. This is a very dangerous intersection.
Mm-hmm. That I don't understand why that's part of the river.
Well, let me elaborate with other thing, and I will get to that. But if I don't, to your satisfaction, don't let me get away with it. Okay. So the other day I was behind that desk over there, and I heard this sound. And I looked out, and this pickup truck had hit a bicyclist right in this intersection here. We've had many people struck. My own car has been bashed at that intersection when I stopped for a guy in a wheelchair, and the guy behind me didn't see that I'd stopped for that. So it happens not infrequently, right? So I could... indulge the thought, in my own case, where my car got hit, that guy was wrong. The universe was wrong. Something wrong happened. This isn't part of how the river's supposed to flow. And what I'm saying is, the river is bigger than our projections about it. The problem with the metaphor of the river is that it doesn't tend to, in our minds, it doesn't tend to include the sucking sound when we get pulled under. right? And that's part of it too. That's part of the universe. That's part of the processes of the universe. The people who are going into space now are more subject to it. We take it more for granted because we have air here, which actually, with our fires and stuff like that over the last year or so, isn't as great to breathe all the time as we might wish, as I've discovered. Or if we're just going down the street here and someone, you know, strikes our car, that's part of the river too.
So
that gets back to then what Stuart was saying about how we respond and contextualize these aspects. Go ahead.
So please.
Did that answer your question about how it's part of the river?
Well, on the surface it does. It has to be incredibly let go of so much, like boundaries and psychology and judgment and that billionaire is like, we need so much here, what about activism? And everything is just coming into my head about letting it flow, or, you know, standing up for what you believe in, or, you know,
I see. What you're saying. Well, I mean, you have to realize that everything, that every part of your makeup, every part of my makeup, and everyone here, is part of that flow. You know, if we imagine ourselves separate from it, that's a misunderstanding, it seems to me.
I'd like to address that. This came up in our, a topic like this came up in our study group last night. And when we talk about going with the flow or being in the flow, you know, there's a suggestion, as I was saying earlier, about experiencing freedom regardless of what's happening. That doesn't necessarily mean that the that flow or that freedom is a passive state where we're just sort of floating down the river. So in the case of things like activism, there may be circumstances that present themselves that call for an authentic response, and a non-authentic response may be a passive acceptance or sort of turning the other way or not acting. At the same time, and this is very subtle because many times the response that arises that may be an activist response, like a sense of anger and a sense of mission and purpose, may itself be a conglomeration of mechanical factors that doesn't ultimately represent an authentic response, but represents a identified response. And how do you recognize that? When we see political polarization, for instance, and you have people, regardless of their political stripes, representing highly polarized points of view in a kind of a righteousness and a objectification of people who oppose those points of view, one might argue that that's not ultimately an authentic response to a circumstance, but that represents a mechanical or identified response. And that in itself, as what we're talking about, may be grounds for a kind of inquiry, because that doesn't represent freedom. Freedom may represent something arising from the silence that is true for us, that when we take action or are present to whatever we need to be present to, we can immediately let go of and forget about and go on to the next thing. Things that don't have that kind of freedom tend to be sticky, and they cling to us, and it's kind of like a something that we can't quite shake off, and it keeps coming back. And so it's an important question, because it's a subtle one, because this isn't, we're not talking about a kind of a passivity or a kind of non-action in a one sense, and in another sense it is non-action, because if you define action as something that kind of arises as a result of a cause.
Well, think about a swimmer in a river. A swimmer can add to the direction of the current wherever she or he is at any given moment, right? Or can try to fight the current. or the winds, or whatever circumstances are present. So it's like that's if we exclude those considerations, then we're not seeing the entirety of the picture. That would be, and I'm saying that if we don't see the whole picture to the extent we see a greater picture, then we're seeing a truer picture. And that can empower us more than if we're only seeing a smaller bit of the picture.
Or acting out of compulsion.
Right.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Betty?
In terms of your own accident out here,
mm-hmm.
if you're not assigning good or bad to it,
mm-hmm.
the upside was that he didn't push you into the wheelchair,
right.
which really would have been a disaster.
That would have been bad.
And the downside is that he struck your car.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the flow, I think that this is something that you could realize at the time and not assign good or bad to the accident.
Sure. Well, I mean, this text on trusting the heart that I referred to that Jim did is all about not identifying with designations of good or bad.
Absolutely.
And the invitation of the mind and the heart as well is often exactly to do that.
Yeah, of course.
Exactly to do that. So but then we have to realize it's not bad to do that. It's just part of a smaller part of a much bigger whole that we can come to appreciate and expand our awareness to encompass.
And I had another observation to make, and that was when you were talking about inner freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of people like Dietrich Bonhoeffer
uh-huh.
and Nelson Mandela,
mm-hmm.
who I think retained a kind of inner freedom even though they were incarcerated and abused.
Good examples, and you know, there were people in the, you know, the Nazi Holocaust camps that, you know, similarly were able to resist. Actually, a lot of Ursula Le Guin's books stories that I've been reading lately are all about that sort of, you know, how do people do that, and it's not as if it's easy, obviously.
Yeah, and Gandhi comes to mind as well. I think about Gandhi in the terms of activism, you know, when we, going back to the question of how do you recognize authentic activism versus inauthentic activism, in one sense you can see it in the results, because Gandhi, you know, even though, you know, like any human being, you know, he had his faults and benefits, but the purity of his intent galvanized a nation and not only transformed, you know, India, but transformed people who came in his path, like Martin Luther King, to affect a kind of a response to obstacles in the flow that moved and changed society on a large scale, which is different than, you know, a small kind of activism that gets caught up in its own kind of anger. And so there is freedom in action, and there's freedom in inaction. But when a challenge presents itself, when an authentic challenge presents itself, and we can recognize that, and we have the clarity to recognize it, we won't feel free if we let it go. We'll feel bound by a kind of identification with avoidance. And we all have had those moments where you know you have to do something. You just know, and it's like a whole body knowing. It's not like an idea. It's not like something born out of anger or moral outrage. It's like a whole body knowing that I have to do something. I have to take this action, whether it's in your personal life, whether it's in your social life, or whatever. And those, and when we ignore that, it feels like bondage. It feels like we are held captive by something.
I thought of favorite cartoon of mine. Remember the Kathy comic strip from the 80s?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one that sticks in my mind the most is that she was in her thought bubble, she's really mad at her boss because he did this and he said that, and all this stuff is happening and she's really mad. And then the boss comes in and she says, oh, that's okay, and says such and such, and she says, oh, that's okay, all right, I'll fix it, you know, and everything. And then later she's contemplating, she's mad again at herself for not saying this and not saying that when he did that. And then she asks the question, how can a person be so magnanimous in the present and such a pushover in hindsight? And I probably remember that because I've been a pushover in hindsight, mm-hmm. when I thought I was going with the flow or, you know, being,
yeah.
whatever. Not that I necessarily always do that, but that's kind of stuck as an example. She really needed to have a conversation with the boss or say, no, that wasn't all right before she could accept it. And I've had to have unpleasant conversations with people before I could let go of a resentment.
Mm-hmm.
And including acknowledging my part in the situation, if there was one.
I'll make the comment that first, usually it's the, at least in my experience, usually it's thinking about it beforehand that's by far more unpleasant than the actual conversation, usually. Because mm-hmm. usually the key part of a conversation probably takes about 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it might take more. You know, sometimes it might take less. I've experienced both. But it's usually this state of where you're almost at war with yourself about should I, shouldn't I, how can I do this so he'll still like me, or, you know, all kinds of stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuff is the bondage that I think Stuart in particular was pointing to earlier, about this internal bondage. That no one's imposing that from the outside. Now, it is the product of habits that probably that we've picked up since a very early age, I mean really, really young, and added to over the years. And so it's got inertia to it, that set of habits. You know, real inertia. But that doesn't mean that it is beyond our capacity to examine and play with. That's the other thing that sometimes gets left out of considerations of freedom, is the element of play that is associated with freedom. So we think of little kids as feeling free a lot, right? And that's because when they are acting and playing in freedom and with in connection to and as an expression of their creativity, they're in this marvelous energetic space, right? Really amazing. And so that's an expression and aspect of freedom that as adults we sometimes lose touch with. We forget that is available to us. It is available for us to feel like we can play with these things, even the things that have so much inertia that want to hold us back from, you know, as in the example that you used, Dan, with you know, people, power-possessing beings, perhaps, as in a boss, or, you know, power-possessing beings as in someone you were in relationship with, whose opinion of us matters, or who we want to have act in a certain way to us, you know. And so if we're tied to that, then we're giving them our power about that aspect of the relationship. So, but if we remember that we can have some freedom about this, and not take it so dreadfully seriously. That's another aspect of freedom. It's not the only aspect, but it is one aspect that we, by which we can remind ourselves that freedom does not have to be this heavy thing that, oh, if only I could have freedom from whatever it is, or freedom to whatever. I think freedom from is usually the one that feels the heaviest. Freedom to is a little, I think, a little lighter. But anyway, thank you.
But it's still, freedom to still suggests or emphasizes or calls into being a obstacle.
Yeah.
And another way in I wanted to, it's a slightly different, but connects to what we're talking about for this notion of freedom, is tied up with the notion of mastery. And I'm reminded of a story. I had a college friend who was living in Boulder, Colorado, and he once told me about running into this guy who lived in a cabin up in the hills above Boulder. And this guy was a violin player, and quite accomplished violin player. And so he was expressing to my friend that when you see a master of their art, like a master violin player, and what this guy was aspiring to be, he says, that's true freedom. And that always stuck with me, because I was trying to think, well, what does that mean? How do I understand that? And one way, and I understand that now because I've practiced and worked with a musical instrument, a Japanese bamboo flute, for many years. What I see in that progression is, as I deepen in my relationship to that instrument, my ability to express something true within myself through the vehicle of the instrument becomes more and more accessible. It's not like it ever ends, or it's not like there's, it's never like there's a endpoint to that, but there's a sense that freedom, when one has practiced and disciplined oneself with a musical instrument, isn't so much a freedom from, in the sense that I'm playing a piece of music. There's lines of Bach or something like that on the music, and so I'm following a structure, and yet there's a undefinable kind of freedom or spontaneity that a great musician demonstrates that touches us and expands our hearts when we hear it, and we know it when we hear it. It's something that's very powerful and beautiful. So the way I connect this is that a great musician or a great master in that way, just like a great artist, has a powerful freedom to be kind of spontaneously true and authentic within the context of their discipline. I sometimes think about that when I look at sacred art, like Tibetan tonkas are a good example. If you look at the contrast between a student piece that you can usually pick up for, $35, $50 versus a masterpiece, which could be thousands of dollars, it could be the same image, and it's the same geometry and the same implements and things like that. And yet, in the masterwork, there's a subtlety of expression that touches us in a way that the crude or student work doesn't, even though the image is the same or the thing is the same. So if you take that analogy to what we're talking about in terms of our relationship to our inner habits and tendencies, our tendencies of mind, what thoughts we have that we project onto the world, what feelings we have in reaction to the things, the events that happen in the world. If you look at that as a, in the same way as we might look at the disciplines of practicing a musical instrument or of painting, that without a certain kind of inner work, without a certain kind of discipline of attention towards the arising of the phenomena of our consciousness, our expression in life, emotionally, reactivity-wise, has a kind of a quality like that crude tonka. You know, the forms are there, but the lines might be kind of sloppy, and the colors of our emotion kind of bleed past the lines. And when we work with attention and just become more and more present to that inner activity, there's a kind of a alchemy that can take place in which that activity is transformed in a way such that the nature of our beings, the expressions of our personalities can become something that is an expression of something true in ourselves, just like when a master plays a piece of music and there's a expression that touches other people's hearts. So if in our presence, just as an ordinary human being living our lives, we can touch other people's hearts by the quality of our being, by the quality of our presence, that to me feels like a kind of freedom that a great artist aspires to. And so in this sense, we're kind of making the analogy that spiritual work is about the artistry of life, the artistry of living a life, and how do we take this complex instrument of expression, which is has all of these feelings and thoughts and actions and things like that, and bring to it a kind of an attention and a kind of discipline that an artist brings to their particular instrument of expression, such that from that very inner silent place of ourselves, that truest, most subjective point, can arise an expression that touches the world.
So that's where the slavery comes in.
Well, that's actually, that'll come to it. That's another step there. Because in a sense, I'm still speaking about, and still framing this in terms of that inner part is something true about ourselves.
But there was the discipline that led up to that mastery was some kind of slavery too, right?
In a sense, yeah.
Practice.
Well, you can say that. And I think in a sense, yes. Because one follows a discipline, whether it's a meditation discipline or a discipline about art or music.
Well, but think of it this way. I mean, you know, the man who goes out in the South into the field and picks cotton, is he doing it because he chooses to do it, or is he doing it because if he doesn't, someone's going to enforce some kind of punishment? So what's the reason? That's an obvious external sense of freedom, but some of the most inspirational writing from people who went through the Holocaust, for example, they could be in these circumstances where they had no external choice or very little external choice to what was going on, and yet they could manifest a heart opening that other people found miraculous to be able to experience in that incredibly difficult set of challenges. So it doesn't matter exactly what the externals are. Stuart used the word mastery a moment ago, and it reminded me of a book that meant a lot to me years ago when I first started my spiritual practice, called The Master Game. So the idea, it's by a guy named Robert Tarrop in what's called the Fourth Way tradition, and the idea is, in The Master Game, is that spiritual practice is the master game of human accomplishment. Not that everyone's supposed to do it, but that it encompasses all the possibilities of that we experience as embodied human beings, because we're constantly looking at all the obstacles that we have to freedom of expression, internally as well as externally. And so that challenge of finding freedom is, as I was saying earlier, sometimes we experience that itself is a burden, but we can make it into a challenge that expands us, like taking up a musical instrument or a sport or whatever, you know, whatever challenge we happen to undertake. And that's freedom. You know, if it's a sport, we have to follow the rules. Otherwise, it's not much of a sport. It's just people running around doing whatever the hell they want. And, you know, that's what kids do sometimes, young kids. But as they get more sophisticated, they do learn how to play games in ways where they find freedom within the context of the rules. Our friend Jim here is a poet, and he's a big advocate of poetry that follows structure and finds meaning within the structured rules, as opposed to just free verse. Not that there's anything wrong with free verse, but there's also enormous, as Stuart was saying, with a, you know, you're playing a score, right? But there's freedom in how you express each note within the playing of that score. So it sounds paradoxical, and yet it's a way for it's a way to get practice in finding the capacity for freedom in any moment, no matter what those external or even internal circumstances are. If the internal circumstance is to resent the guy who hit my car because he wasn't paying attention, then I didn't and don't have to be mad at him. You know, he was just doing what I've done at times, which is not pay attention when I'm driving the car. You know, some thought comes into my head or something going on outside the road or whatever it happens to be. I've done that. Why should I get mad at him for doing that? There was no point in it. And you know, it was a happy, you know, relatively happy thing for me because he took full responsibility for the accident, and so I didn't have to have his insurance company fight my insurance company and all this stuff. It was a relatively, you know. I got, you know, some physical therapy for my neck and stuff like that, you know. It all worked out relatively cleanly, given the circumstance of what happened, right? And that was, at least in part, I'm convinced, because I didn't run out there with anger at him. And he was able to say, yeah, sorry, I'm really sorry. He was very apologetic. But if I had met him with a mechanical reactivity, I don't think it would have been quite as pretty a picture. So we have to remember that when we're searching for freedom, it's both external and internal at the same time. And how we discover the most freedom in the moment is about the context that we place the event in. So I remembered to place it in the context of, oh, I've done stuff like that too. Oh, I know what it's like to, you know, you come through that intersection over there, and a lot of people are really, if not flooring it, they're really accelerating a lot because they've waited to get through this obstacle of an intersection, and now they're in a hurry to go wherever they're going. And I get that. I've been there. So it's neither good nor bad. It's neither right nor wrong. It was too bad that he wasn't paying attention. It was a good thing that I did pay attention and didn't hit the guy in the wheelchair, and that he didn't push me into the wheelchair. That was good. I was glad for that. So it could have been worse. So it could have been worse.
So there's something you raised there that's an interesting point that speaks about gradations of this kind of mastery, which is, as you described this process of how you could have responded to the, holding the context, you know, there's holding the context of, I don't have to be mad at this person. And from a point of view of practice, we often find that the attempt to hold on to a context will feel some resistance because there's this emotional energy that's wants us to change the context. We want to be mad. We want to, you know...
this shouldn't have happened.
Yeah, this shouldn't have happened. The broader context that underlies what Rob's describing is bigger than just the, you know, the statement, oh, I've done this before. You know, that's a kind of a compassionate understanding response, but there's, in the tantric tradition, there's the idea that whatever is happening, whatever is arising in this moment is an expression of the divine. And when something arises, presents itself to us, the bigger context that can be held is the context that this is the divine speaking. This is, you like the word God, this is, God manifesting, or the divine, or the universe. This is the universe expressing. And the tantric practice, which is articulated differently in different traditions, from the ancient Indian traditions to the Buddhist traditions to kind of the, even it comes up in various forms in modern traditions, but the simplest, pithiest way to say that is to say yes to what is arising. So when we frame it that way, it becomes a little simpler to see it from moment to moment when a no comes up. And we can see that saying yes has a different, saying yes is being present to what is appearing. And again, I want to be clear that saying yes doesn't mean rolling over and being a carpet, or being a rug. It means being present to what is happening and then responding spontaneously and appropriately with what is, feels like a yes, and not holding on, but being saying yes to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And so that saying yes has a qualitatively different feel than the arising of a no. And we can see the arising of the no. It's like we want to push the moment away. We want to blame. We want to identify with a story about circumstances and things like that. And recognizing that distinction is an important aspect of this kind of practice. The practice means continually coming back to the broader context of the expression of the divine and the practice of saying yes to what is happening now. You have a...
Yes, I want to... Are you saying then that everything that happens is supposed to happen?
That's a tricky thing to say because, but in a way, I'm saying that everything that happens necessarily is an expression of the divine, and that when we find ourselves in a happening, how we respond to it is an element of this question or conversation of freedom that we're having. So, I mean, even an example, Rob was mentioning, these extreme examples of, like, people in concentration camps. I was strongly impressed and affected by reading Viktor Frankl's work, with A Man's Search for Meaning, where he describes his, what's fascinating to me about him is, before the war in Vienna, he was a psychologist, and he was just getting started with this theory of logotherapy and this thesis that what really drives humans is having a sense of meaning. And then he didn't leave Austria when the Nazis came in because his father didn't want to leave, but the rest of his family got out, and he stayed, and then he ended up ultimately in Auschwitz. But he was present to this. What gave him meaning was he was testing his theory. It's like, Here's the laboratory, the most extreme conditions possible, and what continued to give him meaning was partly this understanding that he was coming to, and recognizing that the people who were most resilient were the people for whom there was a kind of a meaning in their lives. Now, I don't want to go into logotherapy right now, but what I'm suggesting is that in that darkness, there was the light of the divine shining forth. And and his, the choice that he was presented with was, how do I respond to what's happening now? And he responded in a way that created possibility that was expansive for the universe, rather than responding in a way that was a contraction into oblivion. And that's a very extreme example, but every moment of our day is filled with micro moments where we're faced with the same opportunity and the same choice. And being present to the saying yes to what's happening as a practice is something that builds a foundation of presence, an energy that gives us greater resilience to deepen that relationship to the arising of life itself.
So, there's more we could say, but I'm feeling as if we're coming to a place where I want to find out if there's any further questions, comments, reactions. Yeah.
So, what I'm curious about is, so if you get to this place where you're expanding your consciousness, you're shifting context, and then kind of just fit in which context works best for the situation for you to be kind of in poor with whatever divine expressions in front of you, like, how do you preserve meaning? Yeah, when you're just, I mean, it feels kind of like, yeah, how do you preserve meaning when you're in like this state of complete non-attachment?
Well, my response is, you don't preserve it, you're constantly generating it. By creating that bigger context and finding this new arena. So if there's this successive expansion, for example, happening in your awareness of the circumstances that you're experiencing internally and externally, then that successive expansion, each moment of that, is a new opportunity for the innate and inherent creativity that resides in our hearts and minds, can open and find a new level of meaning, an even deeper and truer level of meaning. I'm not saying that, you know, that it's just like you turn a switch and all of a sudden I'm Mr. Creativity, you know. But as a practice, and reminding yourself that, I mean, I'm not saying anything new here. People have been saying this, something like this, for thousands of years in different ways, in different contexts. But it's important to realize that it is a creative act to expand your consciousness, to recontextualize what's going on from the story that you were holding, not negating the earlier story, but finding a greater overarching story within which a deeper and more coherent web of meaning is possible to generate. So that creativity, that exercise of creativity is also empowering. Even though you're not doing it, in a sense, it's doing it through you, but you're tuning into this divine capacity that Stuart's talking about to generate bigger webs of meaning than you had before. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so would you call that wisdom?
Why not?
Yeah, I think you could call that wisdom.
I can go, I'll go with that.
But I have a another way to express the same thing, because I think you said essentially what I'm about to say, but at a personal level.
But you're
going to
say it much more smartly.
No, actually not. I'm going to make it more personal, because it's. I've sometimes used the expression when I talk about what spiritual work for me is, that it's the axis of meaning around which my life revolves. And so that's, I'm saying spiritual work is the axis of meaning around which my life revolves. And so when I think about the moment-to-moment thing that gives me meaning, it's the engagement in this ongoing practice of trying to return back to the present, return back to the divine, return back to what is now. And that's an active process. Because what I heard in your question or the way you expressed it was that it almost sounds like, hey, once I get there and I can shift this context, it's kind of like just smooth sailing, and everything's won and I'm blissed out. That's not my experience of it. My experience of it is that the ongoing resistance of just simply being in a body, in a form, whether it's a psychological body, a mental body, or a physical body, necessarily creates an ongoing kind of friction that requires that I continually be present to the work of being present to what's happening. And that is meaningful for me. Nothing else, you know, has that level of meaning for me. My job, my career, all of that could disappear tomorrow if it were a function of something that was a calling for my spiritual work. You know, everything, the relationships I'm in, all have as their grounding the primacy of spiritual practice. And so that provides a kind of a meaning that I continue to make active in my life, and continue to try to invoke as often as I can remember to do that. And that's the meaning. You know, it's not the meaning isn't in a frame that is described. You know, the meaning isn't in the realm of the descriptive. The meaning is in the realm of the direction in which I orient my moment for moment activity. Does that make sense? Okay.
Any other final comments, questions?
Well, actually, I have a. If there's another question, that's great. But I have a another point I wanted to do too.
Oh. Well.
The word choice kept coming up.
Yeah.
Freedom. I mean, you're a choice when you're going to get out of the car and yell at the guy. You have a choice in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the key for me. I mean, to
mm-hmm.
remember that choice.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. There's no doubt that the way we experience slavery to our reactivity is that we don't feel like we have any choice but to be sad or angry or depressed or whatever it happens to be, you know, and that's kind of a characteristic of that attachment. The attachment is, I don't have any choice but to do this, and so that's you put your finger on an important aspect of it. Thank you.
I was reminded of a story that before I get into my final point, I'll tell the story. The story was that I was, to put this in context of where I was the one who wasn't paying attention. I was driving south on the road here after some, like a study group or something, so it was dark out. But I needed to get gas when they still had a gas station at that corner before it goes into a two-way street, you know, so right at the end of Main Street here south. And so I was swinging quickly in, and I kind of cut this guy off who was walking his dogs. And he started yelling at me, you know, like, you know, cussing at me and stuff like that. My first impulse was, I'm going to keep driving. And I realized, no, I shouldn't. I should basically, you know, eat this. I don't know what's going to happen. So I got out of the car and I went over to him and I said, "Hey, look, I'm sorry. I wasn't paying attention. I see that I cut you off." And he just suddenly like was shocked. And then I shook his hand. And well, the funniest thing to me in that was, you know, first because it was clear that he was just used to like yelling at the universe, and he had all this anger, but it suddenly just like disappeared in an instant. And the funniest thing to me about that was his dog was confused. His dog kind of looked up at me like the way dogs do, kind of like because the dog just didn't understand what had happened there, because what the dog was used to just didn't happen. And so, the thing I wanted to relate about that is that, okay, I'd made a mistake, but the practice in being, you know, being present to the now was to be accountable for my actions and to throw myself, regardless of what was going to happen, because I didn't know if this guy was going to beat me up or sick his dogs on me or something like that. He just had no idea. But I threw myself into that situation instead of doing the thing that my mechanical habits would have me do, which was I could have just driven off and got my gas later. But then I would have felt bad. I would have felt inauthentic. And yet what I got instead was a transformational moment and a funny story that's actually stayed with me, because it was such a powerful lesson in possibility that it's become kind of part of the bedrock of my presence. So that's the story. And then the point I wanted to return to is the point I wanted to return to was because I brought up slavery to God, and you brought up the question of slavery, and no question about freedom wouldn't be complete without, you know, returning to a kind of a tantric view, which we have a friend named Ken McLeod, who's a Tibetan teacher, runs the Unfettered Mind website and teaching system. He's been a great guest on our radio show a number of times. We were talking about this question with him at one point, I think maybe in one of our radio shows, and his perspective is like freedom is like a true freedom, true spiritual freedom, is to be in such a place that one is moving perfectly in harmony with the will of the divine, or the will of the mystery, if you will, that we're in the flow, but that flow isn't necessarily a comfortable flow, as I was just describing, but we are acting from moment to moment in harmony with the will of the totality. And in a way, when you put it that way, the question is, well, that's not freedom, because now I can't do whatever I want, because I'm somehow aligning myself with something bigger than myself. But, you know, in that Buddhist tradition, there really is no self. You know, this innate, deepest level of subjectivity that we feel in ourselves, that quietest place where there's no words, is the divine. There's no separation, and so aligning ourselves with the divine, being a slave to God, is exactly the same as being authentic and allowing truth to arise from the silence within and to express effortlessly through a psychology of presence and a context of saying yes to the moment.
Thank you.
That dog gets bigger every time you bark.
He who barks laughs loudest. Anyway, thank you all for coming tonight. If there's no further comments or questions, we will conclude. I will note that this Taiyu study group that Stuart mentioned happens on Wednesday nights, except next Wednesday, because we have Mr.
Aikido guy.
Yeah, John Stevens coming, and we had to bump our own group for that special event. But 2 weeks from yesterday, on October 3rd, we'll have we'll resume our usual schedule. It happens here at 7:30.
And at that meeting, we do some of the meditation forms we use, and then have a conversation about many and varied topics.
Right, and what else?
We have a radio show.
We have a radio show, The Mystical Positivist.
It's on Cal's community radio.
You can get our show on the web, though.
Yeah.
Just type in Mystical Positivist. That's the first thing that comes up is our show, because it's not like other people
if you go to
slavering
the web,
to use those two words and link.
If you type in Mystical Positivist, as cool as that name sounds, surprisingly
no one else seems to use it.
No one else seems to be seeking it. So we found something unique on the internet.
Yes, exactly. Wow. That's an accomplishment right there, don't you think?
So
last time I was here, I didn't write it down. I forgot it.
Well, see, that's why a lot of spiritual teachers tell their students, and you know, it's not uncommon to be write it down.
Yeah,
write it down. Write down the phrase or the thought or whatever it is. It's important.
And I keep promising to make a card so that I can pass out cards.
That's a good idea. We have a donation bowl over there. Half of it is usually given to the speakers.
But tonight, all of it will go to the store.
All of it goes to the store to maintain this event space for further such events.
To keep us in tea.
To keep us in tea. To keep the community in tea.
That's right, to keep the community in tea.
Thank you very much. And in spiritual books. So thank you all.
Oh, thank you very much.
And thank you for the questions and comments. Appreciate it. Yay.